everybody. My name is Paul Yock. I want to say hello on behalf of the BioDesign program. We have a great evening in front of us. I want to thank in advance Casey McGlynn, who's in the front here, and Wilson Sonsini, PricewaterhouseCoopers, for their sponsorship of the event, and also Wendover Publications, who's loaned us David for the evening. And David will be, David Kasich will be introducing our speaker in just a moment. One other person I want to thank, this is the last in this year's series of Innovator Workbench, and in the back of the room, Mary Gorman, who has organized the series and put a huge amount of work. Please join me in giving her a round of applause. And let's see, logistics for the evening. So we'll run about, 50 minutes or an hour in the interview format, and then there'll be a chance to answer, ask questions at the end, so please use the microphone for that. After that, we'll have a little reception in the back and have a chance to interact a bit. Please, if you would, turn your cell phones off or turn them to vibrate. We'll be recording the session. And with that, I'm going to ask David to take it away.
Thanks, Paul. Well, thanks very much. Thanks, everyone, for coming. You know, we've just, in the course of this Innovators Workbench series, which has to have been going on now, what, 7 or 8 years now, we've interviewed just about the heads or the CEOs of just about every kind of company. But I think no company has been as interesting as Covidien has been for all it has gone through over the course of the last couple of years. We want to focus on what we're going to kind of call the new Covidien, which is really, I think, putting as much as any company a stamp on the medical device industry. But if you go back to the early days of Covidien's existence, when it really started as Kendall, it's truly been had one of those interesting histories. And Rich Melia, the CEO, has been there virtually the entire way. So, Rich, great to have you here. Thanks very much. For those of us who know the Covidien story, at least on some kind of level, it obviously does begin with Kendall. But just from your background, I know you started with American Hospital Supply. Take us a little bit through your career to the point at which you got to Kendall. Sure. What did you do for American Hospital Supply?
I worked for the pharmaceutical division. I started in sales and moved into sales and marketing through the nursing products division of PharmaSeal.
Give us some sense of what kind of products those were.
Hospital supplies, urology and syringes and needles, gloves, basic, floor use products primarily. And then went to the Magad division where I was vice president of sales and marketing and was there at the time that we were talking about this on the way over with Paul. If anyone remembers, it was one of the craziest times, but American Hospital was going to merge with HCA,
right?
And the company was going to be called Curon, and we were in disbelief because we were trying to figure out how we could become part of a hospital group that Rev Gilliland. He had gone from Magad to Intermedics, then to AMI, and he went to Kendall in 1990, and it was him going to Kendall that brought me there about 6 months later, and so private company, failing LBO, what we needed to do was to take the company literally through a prepackaged bankruptcy. And so while it wasn't a lot of fun doing that, it was incredibly educational experience to just do what you had to do to take a company, through a bankruptcy proceeding. And it really did establish kind of a foundation of the Kendall culture where, today when you do reviews for capital investments, you're looking at multi-million dollar investments with paybacks, 3, 4, 5 years. Back then, if it didn't pay back in 60 days, you didn't do it. Cash was so important. So we really learned what it meant to appreciate and sacredly guard cash. About a year into it, in 1992, we emerged from bankruptcy as a public company. At $10.30 a share, and then 5 years, no, 2 years later, Tyco had decided they wanted to expand from an industrial conglomerate into more of a conglomerate with a healthcare offering. They paid $60 a share for the publicly traded Kendall
company. So Clayton Dubilier's got some money back. Did they ever make
the next round?
Was that ever net positive? They made it up.
They made, in fact, the price at which they sold it for, it's like $60.12, something like that, and it was exactly the amount that was necessary to offset the loss on Kendall Part One, and so it was important for them to be able to say that they've never done a deal that lost money.
So you went, you were acquired, in effect, taken private. Was Tyco a publicly traded company at that time?
Tyco was publicly traded.
But you now became a unit within a large publicly traded company.
Correct.
1994, what was it, about 2 years later that Kendall slash Tyco, and I guess we should call it Tyco, but at that time it was mostly Kendall, right, went on one of the most interesting and amazing acquiring sprees that anybody has seen in the medical device space. In the late 1990s were an incredible time for M&A in the device world. Medtronic was buying a lot of companies.
Right.
Johnson & Johnson was buying a lot of companies. But few companies actually matched Tyco at the time for its acquisitions. Take us through some of those deals. And was there a strategic rationale? Was there a vision for what Tyco wanted to become behind all of these deals?
At the time, Dennis Kozlowski, probably someone you haven't heard of, was running Tyco, and he did some things that he shouldn't have done, and he's paying the price for those things. But he also, deserves credit for kind of the vision to create a big healthcare company. That was the vision. There wasn't a strategy in terms of the kinds of companies that that Tyco was necessarily pursuing, but to get more into healthcare, because the healthcare piece compared to fire and security and construction projects, that's so cyclical, and he liked what healthcare had to offer. So the initial foray for us into deals was primarily into the Kendall-like product. So we acquired Professional Medical in brand. Then we acquired Sherwood, Davis, and Geck. And in 1998, we acquired Sherwood, which was about $1 billion in sales, couple billion in purchase price. We acquired Graphic Control for about $600 million, which was electrodes. We acquired U.S. Surgical, which included Valley Lab, and that was probably $1.5 billion in revenue, paid $3 billion, and the final piece was the baby diaper company Confab, for about $800 million. So that was four big deals.
Those are four big
in
deals
in 12 months. And what Tyco wanted to do was just create size,
right?
And that's what they did. The vision wasn't to create growth, but it was to create immediate profit improvement as a result of very aggressive integration.
So you were also compiling what at the time, a lot of those names actually aren't well known now, but if you go back to the 1990s, and I actually started in the hospital supply industry, you were gathering together some of the most prestigious brands in the space. How much of this was about getting the right mix of brands so that when you went to customers, what they were seeing from one company was Kendall, U.S. Surgical, Davis and Geck, Sherwood?
Well, I think the early days it was, it was that strategy, because Sherwood was Kendall-like, in-brand ProMed, Kendall-like. When we acquired U.S. Surgical and then Mallinckrodt, that was when we moved beyond just the supplies and started getting more into devices. And that was a critical point for us. The good news for being part of Tyco at the time was they allowed us to build a very big business and get into some very good franchises, surgical devices, energy-based devices, pulse oximetry, critical care ventilation. These are good spaces. The problem was that top-line growth was inconsequential. It was not part of the model. It was immediate earnings and cash flow. And so the entire strategy behind the acquisition effort was to bring these companies in. And by and large, they were bigger, underperforming companies, a management team that may have lost its edge, and the one thing we had was edge. Mm-hmm. And so we would bring these companies in, and You know, we would integrate back office systems. We would integrate manufacturing plants. Tough things to do. We would cut selling, marketing, R&D because growth was not part of the equation. Mm-hmm. And what you found from the period 1995, we took our healthcare business from $600 million to 2000 when we acquired Mallinckrodt to about basically $9 billion in revenues, but a 1% or 2% grower.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because you had an edge, but you had an edge in part because in an industry that was full of sleepy, tired, non-growing companies, Tyco was an extremely aggressive, take no prisoners, no holds barred kind of company. And just to fill in what is maybe the most interesting piece in this whole thing is this works well until about 2000 and then the wheels come off.
Well, yeah.
So let's talk about what happened in 2002. And I have to ask you, do you still have the dog umbrella stand in your office?
Yeah. That first phase of Tyco was very successful for us because we were using a fastly and quickly appreciating Tyco currency to do most of the acquisition. So, you know, Dennis took the equity value of Tyco from about $3 billion in 1994 to I think it reached as high as $90 billion at its peak. It's created a lot of value. And with that appreciating stock price, we then were buying a lot of these companies with this equity. When the scandal hit, and in fact, I think despite the scandal, this was a little bit of a like having a drug habit. Eventually, you were going to choke on it because you just couldn't keep, you know, we were getting EPS accretion, but the return on invested capital for the company was just getting lower and lower. No one paid attention to it until they started paying attention to it, and then it became to be a problem. But simultaneous with this was the scandal involving Dennis Kozlowski and you know, his abuse of corporate assets, and David's talking about the $15,000 umbrella stand.
Well, yours wasn't $15,000.
Mine was only $15.
Yeah. Someone gave you a gift of a dog umbrella
stand. I did, yeah. There is one in my office. It was a joke. It literally is a little ceramic
So what was it like going through that period for you? I mean, we talked about this a long time ago. There was nothing going on at Tyco Healthcare per se, but it must have been both irrelevant to you and distracting at the same time. What was it like to be at Tyco Healthcare at 2000? From what I understand, you didn't even find out about the Kozlowski issues until you read about it in the newspaper.
Yeah, it's true. Most of what went on was not known in the divisions. Mm-hmm. It started in February of 2002 when the Tyco board discovered that one of their board members had received a $20 million fee for connecting Tyco to a company that they, CIT, a company they eventually acquired, and they never disclosed this to the board. I mean, it was totally inappropriate. And that's when the board started looking into, you know, what exactly was going on. You know, is there other malfeasance? And they hired David Boies, you know, Boies Schiller Law Firm, who then hired a forensic accounting firm, and they first focused on Tyco Corporate. And that's when they went through Tyco Corporate, and Kozlowski left, he got indicted, Mark Swartz, CFO, got indicted, he left, general counsel got indicted, he left. But everything was focused internally, and that's when we began to hear about all the apartments, the forgiven loans, the unreported bonus programs. So they finished that investigation and had released an 8K in September of that year. And we thought it was over. And then these same lawyers and forensic accountants showed up at the divisions. And it was hellacious.
Yeah.
In all my years, I have never had a problem sleeping at night. You know, with all the pressures that you might have from family or business, I just could sleep. I had trouble sleeping because you had these people running around your businesses. Unfortunately, as Kendall, as a public company, we established very good controls and policies and procedures, and Tyco didn't affect that at all. And we were subjected to intense review and scrutiny and passed muster, but that process was very unsettling, to say the least, and because you just had people dying to find problems where problems didn't exist, I mean, it's just anecdotally, we were at a fundraiser for Tyco, and it was for some charity in Boston, and one of the raffle items was a weekend in Bermuda, and the Tyco jet would take you down. And so three of us with our wives, we won it, and so we went down, and we said, how do we handle this? And they said, just expense your stuff. So we just expensed it. And 3 years later, now this forensic accountant seeing that Rich Melia flew on the Tyco jet with his wife and two other colleagues, and they just were trying to find all kinds of problems like that. But fortunately, none existed. And then we got through that phase, and Ed Breen came in, and what he brought, I mean, at the time, Tyco stock went from, in like about a three-month time period, from $60 down to $7. And it was WorldRun, Enron, and Tyco.
World. Yeah, just to put a spin on it, it wasn't like they were identifying Tyco. The scandal was worse for you guys because everyone was looking for the next Enron.
Correct.
And for the next WorldCom.
Correct. And you know, politicians were referencing Tyco, Bermuda-based company, as an example of corporate greed run amok. So Dennis is gone. Ed Breen comes in. And what becomes clear is the acquisition strategy is gone because the Tyco currency is now $7 and not, you know, $60. And so we have to grow organically. Well, how the heck do you do that with the way we were funding R&D, selling, marketing? And it was a real challenge. Breen understood. He wanted to give us the opportunity to invest more to change the whole paradigm, the whole model. But he couldn't do it. He was under immense pressure. You know, he came in and cleaned up the governance issues, totally changed the board, put in new controls, new procedures. Sarbanes-Oxley followed soon thereafter. And those procedures and controls got even more intense. But we couldn't run a healthcare business in this environment. And fortunately, to his credit, he was the kind of guy who ran the company with a shareholder in mind. And it wasn't that he have a big company and that he make it bigger and that he have a lot of prestige. And he realized that there's just no way these healthcare businesses could flourish.
Under Tyco.
Just wasn't going to happen. And that's when, you know, he began to think about, with our prompting. I mean, we had been saying, you know, Tyco tried to spin once before. It didn't work. Look at us as a device company, look at electronics as an electronics company, and you do fire and security, different investor bases, different expectations, and he did. And he brought in, I think it was Goldman Sachs, you know, to give him a financial opinion of it, and he brought in McKinsey to give them a strategic view of whether it made sense, it would work, and.
Was there any downside? Was there any reason, was there any argument for not doing it at that point?
I think just the cost to shareholders, because it was very expensive to do, and the risk that we not execute on it.
Yeah.
And because if you had one share of stock, you were going to get, you know, worth X. You were going to get three shares of stock and the three companies worth X.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you could, you know, have a lot of disappointed shareholders if you executed on the scheme and then didn't execute on the business plan that followed the arrangement. So
out of that, in 2007, emerged the new Covidien. Before we get to Covidien and its strategy today, let me ask you two questions about that period when you were wrestling with the aftermath of the scandal. First, was there any fallout among your customers? I remember during that time, if you talked to some hospital executives that in the Federation meeting were in Las Vegas, they would say to you, gee, I don't think it's appropriate that, you know, we hold these meetings. We're charitable institutions. I don't think it's appropriate to hold them in Las Vegas. Did anybody look at the scandal and say, oh, you know, we better not be buying stuff from Tyco because it's a tainted company. The reputation is, we're going to be tainted by association.
It's a great question. The taint was felt by the employees tremendously. Tyco hats, Tyco t-shirts, Tyco sweatshirts, they were way in the back of the closet and they never came out. But the customers, you know, the especially clinicians, they saw Nellcor, they saw U.S. Surgical, they saw Mallinckrodt, they saw Kendall, Curity. They didn't connect Tyco. Buying groups did.
Yeah.
But that saved us. It really did. And I think there were a lot of skeptics who wondered whether a company that had been managed as we had been managed for so long could survive independently of a mothership like Tyco. There were a lot of skeptics at that, whether or not we could pull this off. But it wasn't, we can't buy Tyco products because, you know, of the scandal.
So a lot of your strategy in late 1990s leading up to 2002 was built on this M&A kind of engine and powerhouse, and a lot of it was about stripping out costs and being the low-cost manufacturer. You did the Mallinckrodt deal in 2000. The other deal, the other 2000 deal that fell apart at the last minute because of the problems with C.R. Bard.
Correct.
Was the inability to pick up C.R. Bard an issue for you? And was there any sense as you looked at going forward, now having to grow organically, not having that currency to do deals, that you were kind of halfway through the strategy but not enough? That you did you have enough behind you to really form a base as what would eventually become a standalone company, or did the scandal hit you at a particularly difficult time? You didn't have all your pieces in place. You hadn't really fully executed on the strategy, and C.R. Bard was illustrative of a piece that would have been great.
Yeah.
What kind of shape were you in when you saw all the pieces that you had in place in 2003 for that time frame?
Yeah. From 2002 to 2005, we didn't do one deal. That's a really bad thing, you know, in the device space, especially considering we probably did 50 to 60 in the previous, you know, 8 years. But we couldn't. There was no currency. There was no appetite. Investors didn't want. They wanted to see what we could do as a organically run and organically growing company. So it was a very difficult time. From a financial position, we were great. We generated a ton of cash. Very profitable. Our operating margins would compare to some of the best device companies, but we had no growth. That was our problem. We had no capability to grow, and there was no way we were going to grow in that condition. Bard was an opportunity to bring some growth in, but that was just before the whole scandal. And in fact, like you said, David, the letter of intent was signed in June of 2001, and we normally closed, you know, after all the regulatory requirements, 3 months later. But the Federal Trade Commission came in, and they saw overlap issues, and it took us 4 to 5 months to address those issues. And by then, the scandal hit in 2002. Stock was down. The deal was over. When Tyco decided to do this separation, we knew it was the right thing to do, but we weren't sure it was something that could be done very quickly and very effectively. I'll remember vividly because I had been running Tyco Healthcare since 1995, for 10 years, and I'd been through the growth of Tyco Healthcare, been through the scandal, been through Ed Breen, go more deals, just manage it as best you can, and we did the best we could, and I was going to retire. And because I'd been doing the same job basically for 10 years.
You'd had it.
I'd had it. And then Breen came to me in the summer of 2005 and said, "We're thinking about splitting up and spinning you guys off. Would you stay?" And I said, "Well, yeah, that'd be a totally different situation." And I can remember a meeting in the fall of 2005. This is before the decision had been made by the board, and certainly before it had been announced. And the folks from McKinsey were in, trying to understand our business, and they had up, you know, on kind of on a, in a PowerPoint presentation, what it was going to take for us to create growth and have real robust quality and regulatory systems, good clinical programs, and it was $300 to $400 million, and I remember going to Bill Hewitt, who was the partner at the time, he said, "How do you go to your investors and take $400 million in earnings away and say, we need to do this?" And he said, "The only way you do it is at a separation. And and you'll get the chance to do it because it'll be a whole new slew of investors, and you'll kind of be reestablishing your base. The Tyco investors will be upset, but you know, they're likely going to move with the Tyco industrial businesses, and they did. And he said, so that's going to be your chance.
So who was going to fund this for it? Was it going to come from new investors, from existing operations? Was Tyco?
Oh, we had the cash.
Had the cash.
It wasn't a cash. I mean, we just took our cash and you know shipped it down to Tyco every quarter. So we had the cash. It was the ability. I mean, we generated operating income as percent of sales around 22-23%. And that's where it compared is BD. They're in that same ballpark. We were going to have to take it down to 18-19%. And so that your EPS comes down, your market value comes down. But it was the only way to put the resources in Covidien in order to make it be something other than just a different name, but really Tyco Healthcare in a different exterior. So it turned out to be the only thing that could have saved the company.
So you know, it's interesting because someone who's been around for a long time, I confess I've been around for a long time, there really have been three Covidiens. There was the Covidien of the 90s, which was an aggressive, omnivorous acquirer of companies. There was the Covidien of the 2002, 2007 period, in which you basically really had to just kind of hunker down and do it. And then there's been the Covidien more recently. And I think you mentioned to me in the last 3 years, only St. Jude and Medtronic have done more deals than you guys have
right.
done.
We did no deals 2002 to 2005. As of a few months ago, we had done 11. But the kind of deals we're pursuing are very different. We would go into the Mallinckrodt, and we do a lot of good, but mm-hmm. we do bad as well. I mean, we'd cut unnecessary costs. We would make them much more productive. We took operating margins at Mallinckrodt from 12% to 26%, at Surgical from like 13 up to 25%. These were really good Six Sigma lean manufacturing things that we did, but we also, cut some of the growth.
I knew a lot of people, some of the acquired companies, and they were frustrated that, R&D was cut, valuable projects were put on back burners.
Yeah, well, they were. I mean, it wasn't cut in its entirety, but it was cut more than it mm-hmm. ever should have been. What's interesting, when we had our first investor meeting, it was the first day of our roadshow. Had myself, business heads, all laying out to investors who are seeing the management team. Now, these are healthcare investors, not Tyco investors. They're seeing the management team now for the first time. They're trying to assess us. And we've got this vision, which really made sense. This is what we're going to do. And you could feel a lot of excitement, enthusiasm. And then our CFO, now this is like end of June 2007. We're going public, the next week. And our fiscal year would end September 30th, the 07 year, 08 would begin. And he said the earnings in 07 will be less than they were, or in 08 will be less than they were in 07, and we're going to take them down by several hundred million dollars because we need to make investments in R&D, clinical, sales, marketing, business development. And we literally took our operating margins from that 22-23% range down to 18-19%. There was a lot of disappointment, a lot of questions. But we said to our investors that if we do this, then we can make the investments to create growth and good technologies, really foster a spirit of innovation. We have a supplies business. We're going to run it a certain way. We've got a pharma business. We're going to run it a certain way, and we're going to focus on devices. Innovative medical devices, and our growth went from 1-2% up to 5% to 7%, and has consistently increased over the last 3 years. Our gross margins went from 47%. This last quarter we announced 55%. And what's pretty interesting, when we started this whole process, our operating margins in that 22-23% range, we just guided the street to 21-22% operating margins, up from 18-19%, and in fact, the most recent quarter we were at 22.1%. So in the past 3 years, the management team has really established a lot of credibility with investors because, you know, the value of the company has increased despite us taking earnings way down and hiring 2,000 more salespeople, funding R&D, you know, at a $200 million incremental clip, you know, in 2008 versus 2004.
So did those investors buy into that vision? Did you swap out your investors? You have a different investor base?
Yeah, we lost virtually every Tyco investor. But in came Fidelity and Wellington, Dodge and Cox, Capital just recently came back. And so these were people that, you know, that understood medical devices. They understood the value of investment and the value of top-line growth. And that if you've got a good R&D program and you're funding it, they don't see that as an expense but as an investment. But when you're talking to industrial conglomerate analysts, they don't see it that way. It's really short-term focused, very different. And so when we had these new investors, it enabled us you know, to do what we needed to do. I mentioned to some of the fellows, some of the teams that I met with earlier, The catalyst that we were able to take advantage of in the separation was huge. We thought we understood it. I personally remember meeting with Mike Masalim, took Edwards out of Baxter. Mm-hmm. Lester Knight took Cardinal out of Baxter. Chris Begley took Hospira from Abbott. All these people, because we wanted to make sure, okay, what did you learn? What can we learn from what you learned? And despite that, we probably had the appreciation for maybe 10, 20, 30% max of what the real opportunity is, because when we separated and we set a vision of innovation and technology and we began to act on it, we started paying people, you know, for driving innovation. We used to give out special stock awards. This is just a classic example of what the difference is. We would give special stock awards to people who hadn't qualified for stock options, to people that had the best operational excellence targets, cost reduction targets at the plants. And they would get, you know, stock options, and that was fine. That fit the model. Now we have stock options go to the best, you know, innovation projects, and it's all focused to the folks in the R&D programs, you know, throughout the Covidien. So
that raises an interesting issue, because when you look at the deals you were doing in the 1990s, it was very easy to see and very quick to be able to identify where those deals paid off. If you could go in, and I remember that there was that Bill George wrote a book soon after he led Medtronic, and recounted a conversation with with an unnamed CEO who said the first thing we do is when we go in and slash everything 25%. And Bill George was horrified and didn't take much reading between lines to see that the CEO was talking about was Dennis Kozlowski. But when you're doing those kinds of deals, you know pretty quickly whether it pays off. It goes right immediately. Doing the kinds of deals you do now, how do you know whether those deals are going to pay off and deliver the kind of stuff? Do you worry about the notion that these are going to be less easy to see? Venus may be a great catch. Bacchus may be a great catch. Even something like Aspect, which is a little more mature, may be a great catch. But you're not going to know whether that deal is paying off for you the way you did when you bought Sherwood, Davis, and Geck, where you could go in immediately and
close immediately. Accretive. Those deals were all immediately accretive. We don't know. Our criteria, we spell them out for everyone to understand. Any deal has to have a strategic fit. And then the financial criteria has tied to an internal rate of return, a return on impact on return on invested capital, years 3 to 5. So we know some of these deals aren't going to pay off 3 to 5 years, and not a must have, but I like to have, and every deal has had thus far, accretive from a sales growth and a margin standpoint. And you know, we do postmortems on all these deals every 6 months. We do it for the board once a year, so people are wanting to know if we're getting the returns. And they're not all, you know, returning as anticipated through the pro forma, but most of them have turned out to be very, very good deals. I know we've got several of our Venus and Bacchus employees here. That those two deals have turned out to be really good. And this, the way we've managed this deal, I'm sure they all have had experience of dealing with a bigger company that has been a pain in the butt for them. I understand that. But in terms of how we treat these companies versus how we did in the past, I mean, we did not want to uproot the scientific knowledge here, the R&D effort, the clinical effort. So we kept that in place. We did bring the Bacchus people and put them in the same building as the Venus people. Whereas in the old days, you know, that facility would have been closed.
Yeah.
Everything would have been done out of a Mansfield Bay office. It's a totally different world. So for things to pay off in 3 to 5 years, that's fine. We really, the kind of investors we're attracting, hopefully, are ones that have a long-term view, and they're buying into what we're doing to create long-term sustainable value. And thus far, we've pleased them.
So I've asked this question of CEOs a lot over the last 10 years, and generally I ask people what percentage of deals that you've done do you deem to be successful. The highest number I get is 50%. Yeah. John Brown from Stryker said that he thinks about 33, about a third of the deals Stryker have done to be successful. Are you comfortable with that, or do you expect that you'll have a higher success rate?
You know, just as I said before, the LBO Kendall days taught some real foundation and some real made cultural impact in terms of how we treating ECHO and watching expenses. One thing we learned as part of Tyco, how to identify, how to value, how to negotiate, how to integrate deals. And so I would be disappointed, given our history and some of the capability and competencies that exist, if we weren't above the average. Our number is more like 70 to 75%.
So how do you identify where you want to go next? And let me just give you an example. You are number one or number two in a lot of the areas in which you play, but you're not, for instance, in a place like interventional cardiology. Right. With Bacchus and Venus, you're now dancing around the vascular space. Could you see yourself getting interventional cardiology? Could you see yourself getting into the kind of big-ticket orthopedic space? How will you decide strategically where to go from here? And when you were in the late 1990s, when you were buying a lot of companies, you bought whole franchises in sutures and wound closure, in electrosurgical devices. How strategically do you line up and identify acquisition targets now?
Well, it's got to have a strategic connection, or we don't do it, no matter what the financial payoff. Financial payoffs were the sole determinant under Tyco. We see our job as management of Covidien to create shareholder value, long-term sustainable shareholder value. Acquisitions, M&A, licenses, licensing deals, they have to be part of creating value. I think by definition, the further away from your core you get, the more expensive, the more risk, the more uncertainty, the more unfamiliarity, the more risk that you're going to have with those deals. So therefore, if you think M&A is important and you want to use it to grow value, stay as close to your strength and your competencies as you possibly can. So we have the luxury right now of having created some really nice franchises, and we have low-hanging fruit. So today, you know, we built out, at Surgical, they were in the hernia tacking, metal tacking business. Since we spun as Covidien, we get into absorbable tacking through acquisition. We acquired a synthetic mesh, and we acquired a biologic mesh. We acquired Confluent. Our sales rep from Confluent is here, to get into biologics. Those were all very successful acquisitions that were moving us into what we call kind of, strategic adjacencies. Same call point, more or less, same channels, understand the customers, understand the competitors, understand the reimbursement, understand the clinical issues. The Venus, the Bacchus deal, we had separated the Tyco healthcare businesses in a way that we thought would make sense. Put pharma over here, manage it differently than devices, extract from devices the real supplies, commodities, put them over here, manage them for cash, not for growth. We don't care what they do from a sales standpoint. Generate cash, improve profitability, and now we get our device businesses. We overestimated one of our businesses, our global business units, and after about a year and a half, we undid it, and we took a lot of these products like urology, enteral feeding, temperature that we thought we could grow and improve profitability. We moved them over to supplies. We raised the white flag, said, you know, that they belong there. We're not putting any more effort into that to grow it. But within that, GBU was vascular. Mm-hmm. And we had compression products. We had dialysis catheters. And then we looked, not so much at interventional, but peripheral. Mm-hmm. And we said, that's a space we're in. We're calling on interventional oncologists. We're calling on interventional radiologists. We understand the space. Let's look there. And so Venus was available. Bacchus was available. You know, and so we're building up very aggressively in that space, and we continue to look in that space as well.
A lot of the 1990 deals were critical mass deals. You, mm-hmm. you not only bought new areas, you bought the major one of the one or two major players in the space. Could you see yourself doing critical masses? Could you see going after EV3 or Boston's peripheral business in order to really create a peripheral franchise? Or is that not really the way you want to approach building out this new device space?
Yeah, I mean, it's always dangerous to speculate. But let me just talk theoretically. Those deals, I said earlier, David, the first hurdle is strategic connection. Mm-hmm. There is that for sure.
Yeah.
We would like to be bigger in peripheral vascular. Then the next question is, can you make it work for your shareholders? You know, I think some companies do better than others at bringing value to their shareholders as opposed to value to the shareholders of the company you're acquiring. That's the key. And some of these bigger deals, especially if you're trying to do a platform, you know, and that's why we really don't have an interest to get into interventional cardiology, diagnostics, orthopedics, spine. I mean, the only way to do that is to go buy one of those big players, mm-hmm. and then after you pay the premium, then and we don't know anything about those businesses, what do we bring to create more value for our shareholders? So right now, in the foreseeable future, our strategic plan would not have us delve outside our own kind of platform. But so, what you see, you know, just out of places like, you know, what's going on here, there's just lots of technology development in these very good spaces. Mm-hmm. And that's a luxury.
So you can keep adding to
that. We can keep doing it without just taking those bigger bets with less certainty and greater risk.
So how do you deal with white space opportunities within Covidien? I think one of the most interesting things is, particularly if you look at Covidien of 10 years ago, you now have a VC arm. Where does the VC arm fit? How do you deal with white space opportunities? If there's no better indication of how the kind of commitment you've made to innovation than forming a venture group.
Right. You know, we did that for a lot of reasons, but part of it was that if you look around at the real medical device companies, you know, they all have some degree of a venture arm. Ours is modest. It's our toe in the water, but we've just got some really good people there, and they've already made some really good investments. But more importantly, you know, they're really well connected to, you know, people in this room, people in the venture community. They're able to help us identify clinical issues associated with certain technologies we're evaluating, maybe at the business level. And so that they fill their role in terms of managing the venture fund, because that really, the primary goal, it has to generate good financial returns. But they also serve in that other capacity as well. The white spaces.
Do you anticipate that the companies that Covidien's venture group makes an investment in will be, if not acquisition candidates for Tyco?
Yeah, they should be. They don't have to be, but they should. They have been so far.
Yeah, white space.
When I mentioned we added this $500 million in growth capability, as Tyco Healthcare is pretty interesting. All those deals we did, we didn't have a business development function at the businesses. Mm-hmm. We had four people managing these deals, and so they were top-down driven, and it was all about execution and integration. Now we have business development, portfolio, strategy people at every business. We may have over-clubbed, you know, sometimes pendulum swings a little heavily, you know, when you're trying to move some company culturally, but every business unit, you know, energy, surgical, respiratory, vascular, they have business development, they have strategy people, they have portfolio management people, And they may identify white spaces, but we also have the same capacity internally. And that, you know, that's when we look at white spaces and run models about whether we think it makes sense or doesn't make sense.
So how much time and energy and focus do you spend on Covidien's organizational structure? You've done 11 deals in the last 3 or 4 years. Has it required you to move pieces around and change pieces? You talked about putting farm off to a side and mm-hmm. the supply business, but is that a changing dynamic for you, or do you want that to be the constant and the eternal to which the M&A, into which the M&A feeds? Do you spend a lot of time thinking about whether you've got the right organizational structure at Covidien?
We spend as much time on assessing the portfolio as anything else. It's been pretty interesting. When we were part of Tyco, our poorest performing businesses was a baby diaper business that we acquired. Why, I can't tell you, but or I could, but it wouldn't be appropriate in this venue. It wasn't our idea, but we bought Confab. Well, as soon as we spun, the day one, it was for sale.
Yeah.
You know, we have a specialty chemical business, a Mallinckrodt, day one for sale. So those are no-brainers. They weren't healthcare businesses, but we have since looked at, we were in the sleep business. Now, sleep apnea is a huge market. Good growth, you know, 15% growth, very profitable. And so, you know, we were investing in CPAP devices, diagnostic equipment, interfaces. And we were running up against, you know, the two R's, ResMed and Respironics. And so we just decided, if we can't be one or two, we don't want to be in it. And so we divested our sleep business. And we looked at the return on invested capital because of all the effort we had to put in to try and make this work. It was like low single digit, so we get out of sleep. We had a European syringing needle business, like a $50 million business, 5% operating margins. We pulled out. We've announced that we have about a $180 million nuclear pharmacy network through which we would sell Mallinckrodt's nuclear medicine products.
Mm-hmm.
Makes no money. We're divesting it. And now, the tough call here is you're judged on your sales growth. And so when we lose these, we don't put them into restructuring. We just eat them in the P&L.
Mm-hmm.
And so now investors see, you know, what I just mentioned is probably, you know, $1.5 billion in total in revenue that went away. And unless people understand your strategy and are confident in your ability to execute on this, you can get really penalized. But you know, we've been able to do it, and now once you get those through and you anniversary the date, you know, which you divested them, suddenly they're looking at a much more profitable, better operating margins, better gross margins, better returns on invested capital, and they say, wow, that was a good move doing that. But at the time, there's a little bit of heartburn.
So the thing that you say that it was important to you to be number one and number two, because it seems to me that's very characteristic of the hospital supply industry. I remember I used to talk to Carl Bays of American Hospital Supply. He always made the point how important it was to be number one, number two, because these are low margin businesses. It's about critical mass, about high volume sales. And I remember that when the very first conversation I had with Ron Dolans soon after Guidance spun out, and I said to him, well, how important is it that you be number one? He said, it's not important at all. He said, because in our space, technology will leapfrog. As you begin to focus on a medical device space, by training, by history, by background, by orientation, you still have that. We really want to be number one, number two.
Right.
But doesn't it come with the territory that, you know, it may be smart to make a bet on a small technology that has no market presence because it will be the market leader. And similarly, a lot of the technology in right now are going to be obsolete. No one's going to obsolete, you know, U.S. Surgical or Kendall anytime soon. But they might obsolete Venus or Bacchus or mm-hmm. our Aspect mm-hmm. or Confluent.
I think for the majority of our businesses, it is important to be number one or number two for a lot of reasons, including you really then understand your customer. I think the one thing that we did as we began to shift our focus towards innovation, I mean, we did a lot of things, but no project, whether it be an acquisition, but certainly in our internally developed project, moves forward, gets any funding. We have a very strict voice of the customer. We call it voice of the customer protocol, where you make sure there's an unmet clinical need, that you're going to resolve with this technology. And so, you know, we try and, you know, most of the, we call ourselves kind of a mid-med tech, you know, Bard, BD, that's Baxter, that's kind of our space. And so it's more singles and doubles. It's not getting another coating on the stent and
right.
the whole market flips over. It doesn't move that fast. But we try and make bets in areas that can move the needle. And we're making those bets actually more in pharma now than we ever had before.
Yeah. So it seems to me that one of the keys to the Tyco strategy of the 90s was to have these major brands, these large businesses that you could leverage your relationship with groups like Premier and Novation and the Marinet. Now as you are in the device business and you do it, does that market access channel remain a valuable aspect of it? Or do you basically go to these guys and say, well, look, obviously in our hospital supply business, we're more than happy to put this stuff on contract, but we're not going to put Venus on contract because it's a cool technology that doctors are going to ask for and you guys aren't going to make the market for it. Does that historic strength with the buying groups deliver value to this new medical device strategy, or is it really irrelevant to the strategy?
Well, it's a delicate question to talk about publicly since they're our customers, these groups. But I think there's a role they play. I think it diminishes as you get into more of clinician preference items. It's more relevant, you know, for the supplies end of things. But in terms of what we need to do to grow the device business, I don't think that's necessarily an important key. In fact, you know, products like Venus and Confluent, the marketing people will tend to look at contract and pursue it if it makes sense, but not pursue it if it doesn't. And one thing we do.
Does it make sense?
Yeah. For some it does, some it doesn't. You know, I would say for Venus it probably doesn't, and I doubt we have a contract. You know.
Have the guys ever come back to you and are really mad at you because, hey, come on, we were partners for so long, and now you're turning your back on
us. There's a ton more benefits to being, I think, a broadly diversified medical products and pharmaceutical products company. We think there's lots of benefits. One of the negatives is that your customers can tend to try and leverage you. Mm-hmm. And if you don't give us this deal here, then we're going to squeeze you on the surgical contract award. So, you know, but it goes with the territory. And really, in the end, you know, the people that do the best are the ones that simply say, you know, we're representing surgical, we're representing vascular, I have no control, and sometimes it bubbles up, but we tend to push it right back down. And we're very business unit driven. You know, we consolidate as much back office as we can. We don't think it should matter too much where someone gets an invoice from, to whom someone pays a bill, submits an order. We think that can be anywhere if we have are paying the right attention to the customer. But in terms of, you know, developing products, making products, selling products, that's driven by our businesses, not by a corporate function.
So you're going to continue to do M&A. Is your R&D spending, I know that R&D spending has been going up, is it where it needs to be as far as you're concerned?
Almost. It's getting there. We were at 2% of sales, which is, I'm almost embarrassed to say that, but that was the model.
You had a lot of sales.
We didn't have anywhere near the R&D spend we should have. We're now around 4.2, and we think for our space, given you got a $2 billion supplies business that requires very little investment, if we're up between 5 and 6, we mean surgical's probably 7 or 8, and energy's at 7 or 8. You know, the med tech businesses are in that level. We think that if you look at Bard and BD, Baxter, that's kind of where they are. We don't need to be where, you know, Medtronic, St. Jude, Zimmer, the orthopedic companies.
So, you know, I hope that I've been able to bring out what a fascinating story Covidien is, and I wish we could go on right up against time. Let me ask you a question. If you go back 15 years, Tyco has been through 4 phases. The 1990s, very aggressive acquisition spree, then the scandal, which put everything to a halt, then it was righting the ship for a couple of years, and now M&A again with a new slant, as well as R&D and internal investment focused on innovation. As you look at the immediate near to midterm future for Covidien. Are we still, is Covidien still in phase four? Is there a phase five after this? You must be at the top of everybody's list of companies that they want to come talk to about selling technology, particularly when you come to an area. I mean, you're East Coaster and you come down to the West Coast. How sustainable is Covidien's current strategy, or will it have to evolve into something else?
I think we have the we're still benefiting from the separation phenomenon. There's still a lot of excitement. I think if we spun and failed to deliver on our promises, then it would be a very different place. You'd be interviewing someone else for sure. But the fact that we were able to deliver increased sales, increased profitability, increased returns on invested capital, increased shareholder value, there's still a buzz about Covidien. And now our ability to attract people to come to work for us versus come to work for Tyco Healthcare, it's night and day. I mean, we are getting really talented people, and we're needing a lot of talented people because that's what's driving the success. Venture funds, I don't think, thought for a nanosecond about Tyco Healthcare. And the kind of deals that we're doing, I think people with technology understand that we're serious. We don't take a long time. We don't think overpay, which is, you know, sometimes can be a problem.
But at least you get the deals done.
We get the deal. We can get the deal done, and we can get it done quickly. And we got a very supportive board, and I think it's because the numbers have been good.
So there's no residual. I mean, the Tyco scandal, Dennis Kozlowski scandal, resonated in the 90s, not so much for the association with Enron and WorldCom, but because Dennis Kozlowski had a strategy which was, we go into companies and we just kill them.
Right.
You don't feel any of that feedback now when you talk to companies. No one says to you, is this the old Tyco? They probably don't even know that old Tyco.
You know, I can remember coming out here the day we announced the Venus acquisition and meeting with the management team and the employee group. And I can't remember if I said it to the general employee group or to the management team, but I said, do me a favor, you know, call some of these companies that we've acquired, Sofradim, Tissue Science, some of these smaller technology companies, ask them how they were treated. Because what happened was they kept their jobs, they had more resources to work with, they had a worldwide platform in which to market and sell the products they were developing, and we just enabled and empowered as opposed to, you know, disemboweled. You know, it's very different because that was really, you know, what happened in the past.
Well, great. It's a great story. We're glad you didn't retire 10 years ago because it's been a great stewardship over a company that's really making important news. Let's thank Rich Melia. And if you have any questions, if you move to the microphone. Well, I don't know if anybody has a question. While someone's going to the microphone, let me ask you one that I didn't ask. You very self-consciously had the feeling in the 90s that you were acquiring companies that kind of had lost their edge, that needed the Tyco juice in order to get going. Then you went through a period of 2002, 2007, where you're almost forced to sit on the sidelines.
Right.
Did it ever haunt you that you had become that kind of company that would have been a Tyco target? Did you ever feel as if, oh my gosh, we've become Sherwood and Davis and Get, companies that were kind of hanging on until Tyco came along?
Yeah, it was a very difficult time, which is, you know, ergo the desire to retire at that point in time. There was no way out in the current model as part of Tyco. If we went to Tyco investors, said we're taking $500 million of earnings to develop a growth engine, yeah, see you later. It just never would have happened. But new investors understood.
Great. Question?
Yes, the 21st century seems to be very much about intellectual property. Nathan Myhrvold has acquired 30,000 patents as an intellectual property venture, I think. Tom Friedman wrote a very eloquent article in last week's New York Times about the 21st century and his vision of the small, eclectic medical device incubator as a very expeditious and concentrated process for developing new innovative ideas. And the question I would like to address to you, do you feel that Covidien has made itself accessible to vetting ideas, so-called innovative ideas from outside the institution. You've alluded to the venture capital arm, which I think is interested in our local economy and our local ventures as a means of keeping its fingers on the pulse. But for other entities that are out there, how does one go about approaching and submitting ideas? I know you must get huge numbers of these. Right. And so the question is, over the years, has the process for vetting ideas from the outside and clearly in a corporation where innovation is highly valued, you've alluded to the stock options that are being now directed at individuals with innovative ideas across the company. The question is, how have you evolved the process, and are you prepared to meet the demands of the 21st century IP and innovative economy?
Yeah, good question. I hope so. I think it enabled the process by putting people at the divisions, because when they come into corporate, they need to be determined by people who understand, you know, the businesses, the markets, the clinical issues associated with whatever that idea is attempting to address. So there are now people that can actually be, you know, in a position to gauge and weigh in and make a decision. We were sitting with a fellow who actually, from here, that developed an idea that was being evaluated by our surgical device business. And I was very curious as to hear how that went, because I worry about that. I worry about, we're so big, non-invented here creeps in, and we miss out on an idea. Because if we establish, you know, a reputation of being hard to deal with by people that innovate, you know, in this way, then we're going to deny ourselves huge opportunities. So worry about it. And so, you know, that's why I wanted, this was a good story. I want to hear more details about it, and I want to elevate those that made it happen as an example to others.
Well, one group you must be talking to, that you didn't talk to 10 years ago, are physicians who have ideas and come to Boston or Johnson & Johnson, and now come to Covidien.
If you went to Sages, you know, three or four years ago and asked them, you know, what is U.S. Surgical, which was called at the time, what are they doing in terms of listening to us and responding? And then you go to Sages today, and what's Covidien? I mean, they're all over Covidien now. Covidien's out there listening to him. Covidien's leading the way on sales. Covidien's talking to him about notes. You know, Covidien.
Single port surgery, you guys are establishing
that market. We established the trade name, too. Yeah. Everyone's calling it sales now, and that's ours. So we think we're in pretty good shape there.
That's a great lead-in. I wanted to refer to the SILS effort. That's a core business area for you, but it's traditionally compared to, like, the interventional cardiology, orthopedics, a bunch of surgeons who are much slower adopters, much more hesitant to change. What sort of new innovations are you doing in that market? I know you have your mobile teaching platform.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What sort of innovations and what kind of progress are you seeing in terms of growing that area in a market that tends to be pretty slow to adopt?
It's that's the gating item. So you ask a very relevant question for developing that market. How quickly we get surgeons trained on it. If you were at Sages, we had our new hand instruments on display, and they actually could, they were in a model, and they could look on a monitor and use these products, and it was like a line for 3 days straight. All of our training sessions at our formal training sites are booked for like the next several months out. This mobile training van that you referred to was designed in response to that, because we cannot get people trained fast enough. The other thing we're finding that's a challenge is people will try it for a couple of times and then they'll go away from it. And so, again, that's our responsibility to make. And to be fair, the launch of the SILS hand instruments was the first time they had instruments designed for single incision laparoscopic surgery with more capability, you know, in reticulation and articulation at the working end of the instruments. And so we think we're at a point where we'll start to see more uptake of it. But it is about training. And we had a great discussion with some of the fellows here today who looked at a single port project, and it started out hopefully reduce infection, reduce less pain, and have better cosmesis. And it looks like it's hard to measure pain. It doesn't look like there's going to be data to support infection. So it's going to be cosmesis. We believe that will still drive it. We don't think that's a problem. It'd be better if you had some infection evidence. It's training. The demand is there. Customers want fewer scars, and so this will take off, and we believe we're in a very good position to take advantage of it, and we'll drive it.
Let me ask you just one other question, and then we'll go to the reception. Following a lot of the companies that became part of Tyco in the 90s, it seemed to me you guys have always competed with a bunch of companies out there, but one name always seemed to come to the fore, whether you were Kendall, you were Surgical, Davis & Gekken, that was Johnson & Johnson. Mm-hmm. Johnson & Johnson still competes with you guys in a bunch of areas. But for instance, it is also a company that has transformed itself through aggressive M&A, buying an orthopedics business, mm-hmm. buying an interventional cardiology business, to the degree that, you know, when I got into the industry, patient care was a huge business. Who even knows where the patient care business is at Johnson & Johnson? How much does J&J resonate for you as a model and or as a competitor for Covidien as its position in 2010?
Well, in part of my due diligence, I spent some time with Jim Lenihan, who's with Cerberus now, and asked him about some of the things he did. And one thing he talked about was getting rid of some of these underperforming assets as fast as you possibly can, take the hit on the sales growth, and get it behind you. People will accept it. And that I remember that. He was a very good influence. They're still our biggest competitor. They're very good at what they do, but when the Tyco split up was announced, I can remember one of the sell side people put a report out and said this could be really bad news for companies like Bard and J&J, because for the first time they're going to have a competitor in their space who's really acting like a medical device company. I don't want to sit up here and pretend that this has been rocket science, that we thought is something no one else thought of. This really was the ability to transform the culture and just get people to run the company like a medical device company.
But you've executed.
That's right. What we did.
Did you have to train? Did you have to turn over a lot of senior executives?
Oh, we did. Yeah, we did. People that worked with me for many, many years, but they understood. They understood what we were doing.
It's a new game. Great. Rich, thanks very much, and thank you all. And if I can say one thing, we always thank so many people. We don't thank the one person who really deserves it. That's Paul Yock. Paul, I've been doing this for 8 years. It's just can be a great thing, and it's a great program. Thank you. Great.